Hello, and welcome. I would like to, my name is Carl Sams. I'm current president of ASHS. It's my honor today to introduce our invited speaker for today. Our speaker is Dr. Richard Olson. He is currently the director of the USDA ARS U.S. National Arboretum in Washington, D.C. Richard has a bachelor's of science degree in landscape design from North Carolina State University, a master's degree in horticulture from the University of Georgia, and a doctorate in horticultural science from North Carolina State University. So John Dole's taking credit for all of this, I think, at this point. But he joined the USDA ARS in 2006 as a research geneticist for the Urban Tree Breeding Program at the FNPRU. He reinvigorated the U.S. National Arboretum's Urban Tree Program and developed new woody ornamental breeding projects utilizing genetic tools such as ploidy manipulation and interspecific and intergeneric breeding strategies. His research is focused on the development of superior landscape trees with pest and disease resistance combined with non-invasiveness. Dr. Olson provided scientific leadership for the U.S. National Arboretum Germplasm Program that led to unifying collection and curation efforts within the woody landscape plant germplasm repository, and also in subsequent germplasm characterizations in the program. He's recognized as an international leader in public garden arena, providing his scientific expertise and practical knowledge to multiple national and international arboreta, urban forestry groups, and professional associations. It is my privilege to introduce Richard, and we're all looking forward to his presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Wow, it's a very strange feeling to be talking here today in this capacity, having been a student for so long in ASHS and looking at my professors who are out in the crowd, and all my friends and colleagues and peers. I have one question. Dr. Wettstein and Dr. Mark Van Ursel are winning awards. They were my professors. When did we become the middle-aged, middle-career researchers at ASHS? It's very strange, but time does fly. And I hope today you have a little bit of a reprieve from 2 days of the conference. I know what it's like looking at posters and looking at data. This should be hopefully a little bit of a refresher on maybe why you do what you do in horticulture. Maybe a little bit of random associations to encourage some deeper insights into what you do and how you can relate. And hopefully some pretty pictures, so you guys stay awake after lunch, and we can go from there. But if you're wondering about what in the world a leitmotif is, I'm not a musician, but basically it's a recurring theme or note in music or literature, and it's repetitive. And so it's pretty interesting to think that we don't like collections that are one note. That's repeated, right? If you're plant people, you don't like it if it's just a consistent note. But what we do in horticulture is we try to, and especially public horticulture, ornamental horticulture, sort of combine it into one piece that is both aesthetically pleasing and hopefully has enough layers and depth in there to reach different audiences and connect with people and plants. And ASHS, certainly with the American Public Garden Association, knows what it means nowadays to find ways to connect with the next generation and others. And John Dole's been heavily involved in that with Longwood Gardens and others. And so this is something that weighs heavy on me now that I'm being a director of a large public garden. It is a part of the USDA. We'll get back to that in a second. And so when you combine it well, it's beautiful. And this is one of the most famous gardens in the world, just a little under 8 acres. This is Sissinghurst in England. So this is a little bit of a story about me, too, in the sense that I am a plant geek at the end of the day, if you hadn't figured that out yet or you don't know me. And this slide I took when I was an undergraduate at NC State, traveling around, thinking that one day, based on everyone, mentors, that I may end up at a university and doing this career full-time. So I was shooting slides. So this is an old slide. I just had to show that. So I am at the United States National Arboretum, been there since 2006, and we are trying to combine plant diversity at a premier scientific institution that inspires discovery, understanding, conservation, and ultimately the love of plants. That's sort of a paraphrased part of our mission. And I show this here as a part of a recurring theme is that flower there. This is my favorite picture of the arboretum. That is a real one that's been sort of doctored, but and that's a Franklinia. And so we'll come back to this concept of the Ben Franklin tree and Franklinia as a theme throughout the talk for what I'm talking about. Because in the background you see the columns. And when I first, I think I can say this, I know I'm being recorded, but when I first got to the arboretum, all that our stakeholders and other people could talk about were the columns. And I thought, well, the National Arboretum, can we talk about trees? And so, being a tree person, but anyways, now that I'm the director, I understand how powerful the columns are as for a sense of place in what we do. But we are in Washington, D.C. We are a collections-based research facility, institute, and public arboretum. We're federally funded through the USDA and ARS, the Agricultural Research Service. And we've been part of the USDA since 1927. So we were enacted by an act of Congress, and there's a story behind that. But our mission, because we're always have been part and participle of the USDA and what the Department of Agriculture has been doing, we enhance the economic, environmental, and aesthetic value of ornamental landscape plants. So we are an economic garden. We don't exist as a Victorian garden just to maintain a collection and say, this is pretty. The point in our origins, and you'll see it in a second, was that we have plants so that they are used and ultimately with the goal of enhancing and contributing to the American economy. Now, you have to think back in 1927 how much the Department of Agriculture gave to the economy directly, obviously. We've changed. I mean, we still do. I'm not to say we're not, but you know what I mean. The number of farmers that would have been as a percentage of the population was dramatically larger 100 years ago, 80 years ago. So, and we do that through long-term multidisciplinary research, conservation of genetic resources, and interpretive gardens and exhibits. And I'd like to point this out. I think I can do this in this crowd because I don't have to explain too much, hopefully, who David Fairchild was. But David Fairchild is, what you may not know, is really the founder of the National Arboretum. He was part of an Arboretum committee at the turn of the century that was really fighting for the establishment of a National Arboretum. And I'd like to quote him, and he is here in this picture with the glasses that would be on the left side, receiving from the Secretary of Agriculture, Henry A. Wallace, who the Wallace Belcher Agricultural Research Service is named, our center is named after, the Frank N. Meyer Award for efforts at conserving germplasm and genetic resources in the United States. He was receiving this in 1939. And I know that many of you are on crop germplasm committees in your various crops, and you would know what the Frank N. Meyer Award is about, and maybe you put in your own nominations for that. But I like this quote from David Fairchild when he was explaining about why he set up essentially the Plant Exploration Office. And you've already read it, but I'll read it again. A garden for economic work should possess many species, secured from as many localities as possible, and a collection of varieties which may prove of more importance than the collection of different species. So what does that mean? Well, it means that we need to be focused on cultivated material as much or more than just simply wild crop material. Now, that's a big dichotomy in public gardens where people feel like what's most important is that I have a wild collected plant. But in reality, if you ask the breeders in this room, what you start with is you typically start with something that's already cultivated, is an excellent clone, and is missing some traits. So obviously wild is important, but we tend to forget how important it is to maintain these clonal varieties and this cultivated material because that, in essence, formed the basis and foundation of agriculture. And I do that to get to this. If you're Tom Ranney and John Reuter, who had to actually deal with me in grad school, you know that I get a little distracted on history and other things. But I think it's relevant to think about this context of what I'm giving you today. So there's David Fairchild on the left talking to Frank Meyer at his desk in the office, and on the right is the desk of the director of the National Arboretum, which is the same desk from which David Fairchild ran the Plant Exploration Office. So it means a lot to me that I'm in this position and carrying on this legacy. And Fairchild has seen a little bit of a resurgence. There's a new book from a National Geographic author on David Fairchild. There was one a couple of years ago on his exploits, and I really would challenge you guys to go out and read those books. It's really amazing. But one of the things he also said was that the whole country has been treated as a vast arboretum, the records of which have been kept in Washington. Now, that wasn't us at the time. It's really the GRIN system, the Germplasm Resource Information Network system. So if you're not familiar with that, I'm not going to go into that today, but we are part of that, and it's an amazing resource. And also any of the plant geeks in the room who think, who ask yourselves, why has this not been introduced before? Spend some time in the PI plant books, and you will see that a lot of things have been introduced and were probably lost in cultivation. So it's an interesting thing. But I know I got to get going, but I want to point this one out as well, because it's been 100 years since the death of Frank Meyer. He died this June, 100 years ago this June, on the Yangtze River. He was a prolific plant explorer. You think of the Meyer lemon, you think of tofu and soybeans, you think of Meyer's osier grass. You name the crop, you name the field, and he contributed. And he's standing next to Pinus bungiana, which is the lace bark pine, which was one of his favorite trees. He reintroduced that to cultivation, and it's on the back of the Frank N. Meyer Award. If you've ever seen the award given, it's on the back, and we actually have the original at the National Arboretum. So I'm really proud of that. So conservation, collecting, plant exploration, why we do what we do. This is the ideal American yard. This is in Swarthmore, in Pennsylvania, because while it looks like a typical landscape with small trees and your green meatball foundation shrubs, those small trees happen to be Franklinia elotomaha, Franklinia, Ben Franklin's tree. And it is one of the only trees that has gone extinct in the United States since it was since we've been a country, essentially. So it's one of the few woody plants that's actually gone extinct during this period. And it's a pretty amazing plant. Don't have time to get into discovery, but it was a very small population in Georgia, and it was essentially snuffed out of existence. I like to say that there's no conspiracy here. I think that literally we just caught it on its last breath, and it was headed out the door. And so if we hadn't collected it and conserved it, then it wouldn't be around. It's what we call a conservation species. I don't think it was some disease. I don't think it was at the time the swamps weren't drained and they weren't cleared, but we literally caught it on its last breath. And I tell you all that because this is what we deal with, right? If you're in, this is what you're trying, all the great plant breeders in the room and people are collect, this is the tragedy that is the American landscape in some areas, is that there's like three species there. And what great potential would it be? And how did we get to this point where you push the wilderness away? Well, we've been doing it for, I don't know, several hundred years, probably a couple millennia as humans have settled, that we were tiny enclaves in a vast wilderness for most of our existence, and we've been pushing the wilderness out. So this is a picture of a historic farm in Pennsylvania, and that's what it would have looked like 150 years ago in some areas, 200 years ago, 400 years ago, as you were clearing the wilderness. And we took that to an extreme, right? All of you of my age learned about manifest destiny, everyone, that it was destiny that we take over this land and we'll use all these resources. So this is what we did, and we did a really good job of it. And we have rich resources to deal with. So Andre and Michelle, we had all these botanists coming through the eastern United States. And so here we are celebrating the pioneer French botanist Andre Michaud going through western North Carolina, and it's really amazing. And that's the site. That is what's left of where he went through. I'm sure he wouldn't want to stay there when he came back. Is that Johnson grass for you people? So when I moved to D.C., this is what I was looking for, was a house. And these were the new homes in this area. So there was an area that basically something on the order of 75% of the urban forest in the outer counties around D.C. was lost in the last 20 years. As new developments and density came. So we are, urban sprawl is really contributing to this. This is my garden. Again, I'm a plant person. And the only thing I'll show you there, it's my old garden actually, is that there's probably about 9 families represented in 3 orders, maybe 2 orders of plants, and probably even higher classification as well, divisions. So we rely on diversity in our gardens. And how do you connect? My son, this is my oldest son, he does not care what that is. Some of you know what that is, hopefully. Pedicides japonicus is a giant Japanese butterbur. He doesn't care what that is, but he has the time of his life in there and connecting with them. I cared, but I represent less than 10% of the people that go to a botanic garden. I'm an expert. Most of the people we're connecting with are not. So why are we spending 90% of our interpretation on 10% of the people that already get it? So as you think about that, how do you reach people who are not the experts that are coming to your gardens? I like it because it's a winter flowering perennial. So anyways, and this idea of kids and connecting with plants, it's lifelong. I just put this in here as a plug for Dan Hinckley. Dan Hinckley is pretty much the foremost ornamental plant explorer in the world. He ran Heronswood. I got to intern out there. And here he is in the woods of the Blue Ridge Parkway coming to visit when I was up there for a PhD. And the first time in his life he had ever seen American chestnut as a stump sprout. So here we are 100 years later, and we still just have stump sprouts of American chestnut. We really need to nominate him for the Meyer Award, and I won't tell you why we have to do that. We're running out of time, so we need to do that. Plant exploration. I got into this from plant exploration. Famous books. Why can't I remember the gentleman from Iowa that's amazing? Fruit guy. Come on, John. He's wrote a lot of books. Come on. Who? It'll come to me later. It was in his book. Anyways, it's going to come to me. He's a fellow of the society, and I'm losing my mind. Anyways, Queen Hatshepsut's original sort of exploration to bring back myrrh plants from Somalia and plant it in her garden. And so, Jules Janik, thank you. Purdue. But where was he? He was always at Purdue? You know, that part of the country, you know, botanically, it all blends, and it's hard to distinguish. So here's what frankincense looks like. Myrrh is in the same family as frankincense, the Bursaraceae. How many of you ever heard of that? What in the world is the Bursaraceae? And the reason this is important, because, again, for thousands of years, humans have relied on these plants for their economies. And how do you tell, like in Scientific American here, that, you know, frankincense, which has been collected for its resin for thousands of years, how do you go in to tell those societies that have nothing else, no other means for income, to stop what you're doing because this species is going to be extinct? Imagine that, going to the Horn of Africa and telling those societies, stop it, because it's going to die. That's something we have to deal with. How do you conserve something? How do we give them something else to do? So there are some remaining trees in the Arabian Peninsula, Boswellia. And Boswellia is in Bursaraceae. If you ever get to go to the Galapagos, I would tell you to go do it. This is Bursaraceae. This is Bursa malicifera in the Galapagos. And frankincense, myrrh, this is Palo Alto, or the holy white wood. I'm forgetting the common name. I don't deal common names. I speak Latin. And so it's this family that has connections that all have important uses. And so when we think about conservation and what we do, what is it that we could be doing? It's amazing to tell these stories in your classrooms and connect. You never know what's going to collect with a student. There's the fruit. But when you're there, you get to see something like this. This is Gossypium darwinii. So this is, you know, where Darwin was, and it's named after him. And think about what this has done for cotton and for salt tolerance. And if we hadn't had that species, or is part of the cotton germ pool. I know that's an oversimplification. Same thing with the tomato breeders in a room. This is where you can find forms of Lycopersicum cheesemannii, right? So the salt tolerant, or is it selenium now? I should know this as a taxonomist. Salt tolerant tomatoes. And if you look in the background, this is Tom Ranney's picture from the Galapagos, is you see something that was part of the ecosystem that helps vector this. So it's not just plants that we have to deal with. When we think about this, it's societies and it's the other animals that use the plants. And so when we think about conservation, how does this all get married together? Because you can have the plant, but if you don't have the animal, then do you have the ecosystem? And so what do you do when some of those turtles have been extinct on those islands, and then you find one on another island that is 50%, it's a hybrid with the extinct one? Is that good or bad? I would say it's good. Could you breed and select back for the missing species? Does that sound crazy? They're very important out there. If you ever wondered why a punchas get to be tree-like, if you were being eaten on by 400-pound tortoises, you would grow higher than them as well. So, and there it is. And we'll come. So, again, if you're going to conserve We'll come back to this theme, but if you're going to conserve, think about all of the connections. And we talk about this a lot now with ecosystem services, right? So, again, we have been on this planet and we have been impacting nature since we started. So this is me feeding Charles Darwin's finch, one of the species. Is that, what am I doing? If you've ever read The Beak of the Finch, am I having a profound effect on how that species now evolves or adapts? One time? I don't know. I show you this because it's really important. So these are his original notes. It was Charles Darwin because he was a great observer. That's mostly what he did was observe. And if you look really closely at the top, this is the original sketch of what a evolutionary tree or a phylogenetic tree would look like. And he just simply says, I think. Imagine how powerful that is. I think. I love that. If I ever get a tattoo, it's going to be right here and it's going to say, I think. With this on it. And my wife hasn't let me do it yet. So that's just me holding the first edition, first printing of the Origin of Species. And so now this is not great to go jump into this because you have phylogenetic trees and then you have the molecular trees. But how do we use this in a modern day and why is it important? So here you have molecular analysis of the members of the TACE, the T family, for which our Franklinia, which we mentioned earlier, is in. And so in understanding what to do with Franklinia, if you're an ornamental plant breeder, like this is Tom Ranney's work again at NC State, and if you're interested in how to improve these things, well, who's it related to on the most basic level? We have these powerful tools, which is great. And it's really, as plant breeders, if you don't understand this, you're really missing the boat. And so you can cross Franklinia on the left with Shima on the right, its closest southeastern Asian relative, one of its close relatives, at least from Asia, and then you get the hybrid in the middle. And it's a great opportunity from an ornamental plant breeding point of view, but what does it say about Franklinia? If you're not going to introduce it into the wild, and no one has successfully, and if it's just a conservation species, and there's threats to how you conserve a living organism like that, then is it okay to sort of save some of it in hybridization? For later, it's an interesting part. Because we have so dominated nature in this process in the 21st century. That's the first thing that we have to come to grips with, is this. This is the only science I'm really going to hit you with today, the only graph. Okay. Domesticated nature. So you see these lines. You see population on the y-axis. You see time on the x-axis. And each one of those different colored lines represents a different species at time one. And then over there, you see where it kind of gets perturbed. There's some disturbance event. Something goes wrong. The red species drops precipitously. The yellow goes up. The green and light blue goes up for a little bit. But then subsequently, they drop off. And then you have this blue one that goes up, and then light blue sort of recovers. The point is in this quote, which was great out of Science Magazine some 10 years ago. Now, gosh, I'm getting old. If anthropogenic change decreases diversity, it will likely do so in a non-random way, as specific species are encouraged or eliminated by human action. So part of this is to say we don't know what all will happen, and we are in a period of constant disturbance in our landscapes and in our lives. And so these things are still going on, and we're trying to figure out what it all means. And so this is one thing it means, and it's not to be pessimistic. It's just we have to accept the reality. Our challenge is to understand and thoughtfully manage the trade-offs among ecosystem services that result from the inescapable domestication of nature. We have domesticated the entire planet. There is no place on this planet that has not been touched by man, either by purpose or by accident. You can find plastic bags at the deepest ocean trenches, and you can find pollutants in the middle of the Antarctic ice shelf. We have done this. So the point is we have domesticated a planet, and it is now up to us to determine who comes with us. Because I can tell you, we can't save it all. We can't save it all. It's not possible. Almost 400 species of plants alone. 12 million possible organisms on this planet. We only know about 2 million of them. So we have to understand that. And so when you get to the question of why would you hybridize something and think of it as conservation, it's because of this example with the European auroch. Last seen, I think, in a Prussian zoo. These were the cave paintings you would see, the aurochs on there. It was a huge herbivore in European forests. So if you're restoring European grasslands in the Netherlands, but you don't have the herbivore that maintained it, then you're just treading your wheels. And so what they're doing is they're saying, well, we can recreate an auric. We're going to take the Highland cattle and the other ones with all this molecular data and that we know are very closely related, and we can select for an auroch-like herbivore. So we ask ourselves, what is it that the niches need, and are we willing to do that? And I say this, I don't know how we're doing on time. Anyways, you're just going to have to pull me off. But Carolina parakeet. I'm from Carolina, very proud of it. Carolina parakeet died, actually the last one I just found out, Red, died in the same cage that Martha the pigeon did, 4 years separate, the passenger pigeon. So this is a Carolina parakeet eating cockleburl, xanthinium. So what does it mean that when this species is extinct and you're battling cockleburl in your landscape, did it lose something that kept it in check? What else did the parakeet do? Well, it lived in the bottomland forests and swamps, and where did it live? Well, it lived in cypress, old-growth cypress and plane trees, which were rotten. You know, there's thought that it was extirpated in part by the introduction of European honeybee, which competed with it for nesting cavities in the wild. So here's our passenger pigeon that I mentioned. Again, it's been dead for 100 years. Which is interesting in this, is a great book that came out. As this was getting rarer and rarer, ornithologists kept shooting it to prove to people that they had seen it. And the last one was killed by a boy because he had never seen a bird like that in his life, and he needed to get it identified. That's how the last one died, apparently. So here it is in Stewardia malacodendron, unfortunately a rare and recalcitrant native plant species, which would be great to grow. But it's native, and guess what? That doesn't mean it's good. It's darn near impossible to keep alive in cultivation. It's why we grow the Asian ones, because we have this great one that we can't figure out how to grow. And there's a passenger pigeon with Mark Catesby, and he's on a branch of a pin oak, or one of the red oaks, with the small acorns. And what's important to realize is that when you had 2 billion of these birds in North America, and they were moving around in the winter, what were they feeding on? The small acorn oak species. And they would move around to the pin oaks and to the water oaks, and back and forth. So what does it mean when something like that is gone? Well, what it means is now in North America, we have a preponderance of small oak acorns in both the wild, and we rely on it in our urban landscapes. And here's the problem. So when we try to battle Xylella fastidiosa, which is a horrible endemic pathogen, bacterial leaf scorch, is part of the problem is that we have overplanted with these red oaks, and what do we do? So maybe something somewhere is telling us something. So, and real quick, a couple of years ago in ASHS, it was a great symposium on invasives and the history of invasiveness. And I showed this slide. I want to go through this really quick because it goes back to that cabin in the woods where you had this enclave in the vast wilderness. Okay, think about that. You're surrounded by an intact, healthy wilderness. That's the green. And your little cabin is this white area. And so if you have a non-native plant and you're growing it, it's really tough for it to get established in the ecosystem because it's intact. Those woods are relatively intact. And you have a tremendous pressure back where you live with native propagules, right? So the native stuff is coming back. So the introduced flora sort of persists. So now this is what we have today. Now the green native woods, what's left, are the enclaves in a vast cultivated sea of urbanity. Okay, and so what's the propagule pressure on what's left? Well, one, there's little leaving that. There's little natives left. They've been isolated. But the pressure is the non-native. So again, think about ecological imprinting. When we have these discussions on what's invasive and the problem, think about the larger context, because this no breeder is going to be able to deal with. There are other things at play in society that are dealing with that, domesticated nature. So, but nature is resilient, nature is wild. We're, again, part of the GRIN system, the National Plant Germplasm System. USDA is the single largest contributor to the Svalbard seed vault in Europe, the so-called doomsday vault. But isn't it cool that things can live for a long time, like the people trying to set new records on what's the oldest seed they've germinated? What I think is even more interesting, because to me, seed and conservation is like time travel. If you're a tomato breeder and you don't like society doesn't like the flavorless tomatoes, even though you can ship them and they get there unbruised, and you want to go back in time and recreate something that can handle some some of that with flavor, you may go back to a repository and pull that seed off. You get to almost go back to where you went down this way and start over in a way and reincorporate. So what's interesting here is when they discovered this Silene species that had germinated after being covered in ice for 30,000 years. That's almost, it didn't even recognize, it was similar to the current species, but not quite. So it's almost like we just went back in time. And I think that is so cool to be looking at a species that was resurrected after 30,000 years. Isn't that cool? And it's in our hands. We do this. Now, if you're a native, if you're a conservationist, you cringe at this picture because this represents two parents and a hybrid that occurs in domestication. But because we're ornamentalists and we're horticulturists and there's value in that, we enjoy that. And that does happen in cultivation. But we have a very poor track record of reintroducing things into the wild and doing it successfully. This is one of the rarest conifers in North America, the Torreya taxifolia, the stinking cedar. And it's unfortunate. It's still figuring out why it's in decline. But it is in decline. And it may never actually be able to go back to Florida where it's from. But maybe it can be reintroduced into the mountains of Appalachia, which fit more likely its ideal habitat, having been stuck down in the Florida panhandle after the last glacial period. And you get to see it in the wild. It's great. And then the national champion in Norlina, North Carolina, I finally tracked this down. It's a funny story. But that's it. And there was a time when this was all the rage in the late 1800s. And so there it is. There is this Atlanta Botanic Garden, and they're still doing this, but we're still treading our wheels, right? And then there's things like this that we'll never be able to come up with. This is Taxus floridana. You don't need to see the plant, but what you need to know is I guarantee you almost unless Gary Knox is in here, no one has ever grown this plant. And I think it's wonderful, and I think it's really cool, but if we can't carry it on, there's a reason we grow the Asian stuff. What do we do with that? Again, I'm not being judgmental here, but it's just something to think about is I would love to grow Florida yew, but it's not that easy. And here's Canadian yew, Taxus canadensis, two native species of yew on the eastern United States. So they either represent really great opportunities for some researchers to figure out why they're so recalcitrant and get them into cultivation, or we're going to be carrying them on our ark in perpetuity. And since I've been doing this, plants have been added to the functionally extinct. We drive by these trees at the National Arboretum. Some of you do in other collections. These are Chinese water pine, Glyptostrobus, sort of a relative of bald cypress. We have 600,000 visitors a year that go by these trees, and they have no idea that they've been added to the functionally extinct category in the wild on the IUCN. It is in cultivation. It is a valuable lumber tree, but it's functionally extinct in the wild. Same thing with, something similar with Dalbergia, rosewood. Rosewood is now, that's really important for guitars and furniture. That's our exit at New York Avenue. In 2017, it was added to the CITES list for endangered species because you can't tell all the Dalbergias apart, the rosewoods apart, so they're banning it all. That tree was derived from the one known living tree in the United States in 1961, and it wasn't recollected except by us in 1994 with our partners in NACPEC. So I'm going to stop right here if we have to. I got a few minutes. Are we okay? Okay. So again, along with that theme, conservation, ornamental plant breeding, botanical gardens, and research are not mutually exclusive. They can all be done in one place. Star magnolia is another example for you ornamental people. Very restricted populations in Japan. These people at the National Arboretum don't care about that. But that's okay because I do. And we can do it, and they can enjoy it, and they can picnic under it, and we can grow something very rare, very ornamental for you guys who are not familiar with it. The IUCN has published a number of red list species, Magnoliaceae. There are breeders. There are lovers of magnolias in this room. This is very important. I don't remember the percentage, but a god-awful amount of the total number of species are actually threatened in some form or fashion around the world. These, so here it is, 131 of 245 species threatened with extinction. These plants have been around for 200 million years, so they've done pretty well until we showed up. So what are we going to do about it? The list you see on that page are the ones that are actually ornamental that we use and we grow in our gardens. So again, this is not some obscure thing from a tropical jungle. This is real stuff. It hits home in ornamentals. And again, this is a wild collection from China, Magnolia cylindrica. This is Magnolia dilabata from the cloud forests of Mexico. Saw this in Edinburgh. So it's one of the rare ones. Some of those papers have been published in Hort Science from our colleagues in Mexico. Here's our North American forms of Magnolia macrophylla and Magnolia ashii. Ashii is restricted to the panhandle. We have germplasm people there right now collecting seeds, and Gary's been working with us from Florida and other people, so it's great. But why does this matter? I don't know how many of you are up to speed on your science magazines, because if you're like me, they're just sort of piled up everywhere. But in the last several issues, there's been two great papers or policy or forum papers. One on the left there, biologists raised alarm over changes to biopiracy rules. And then on the right was a little bit later, when the cure kills, CBD limits biodiversity research. CBD is the Convention on Biological Diversity. What's going on here? Well, there's a proposal in the European Union and others is that the Convention on Biological Diversity seeks to protect diversity, but it also seeks to regulate access to those biodiversity. Those sources are the sovereign resources of that host country, and you must have permission to go there. Well, the end result of that is since the CBD was enforced, on average, less than three agreements per year have come out with the CBD and the Nagoya Protocol because it has to do with benefits sharing. However, the USDA and others worked with the seed, Rob, I'm killing this, worked with the agreement on the free exchange of more of the agronomic crops, and those have seen multilateral agreements of on the order of 1,000 per year. And so the CBD was trying to protect biodiversity, and it is ending up killing it because of regulation. So what does that mean? Well, what they want to add to that is not just the species or the plant part, but the DNA sequence. So what is that going to mean for your programs? Even from taxonomic, you just want to do a taxonomic study, you have to have permission to have that sequence. Now you have CRISPR technology, right? That's what they're looking at. They're going to take that and insert it, so those sequences are going to be. So this is going to be, I'm looking at our ARS information folks. Have fun. Let us know what you figure out, because it's going to be a nightmare. And we'll let the regulation people figure that out, but it affects us and what we do as a botanic guard. If I've done anything today then confuse you or bore you, I hope there's been a little bit of entertainment. Enlightenment would be the other side of the bell curve, probably erudition somewhere in between. But go see Dr. Peter Crane, Sir Peter Crane. He can do this better than me. He was the director of Kew Gardens. He is this year is recipient of the B.Y. Morrison Award. B.Y. Morrison, of course, was the first director of the National Arboretum. He's a friend of ours. He comes out and see us, and he is in the Virginia area, which is great for us. So please come out to that talk. So thank you.
Hold on.
Did you hear that, Tom and John? I finished with a few minutes early. It's the first ever in my academic career.
I actually would like to brag on you a little bit for that, because you did finish early, and you were not talking so fast that we couldn't follow you. So. Yeah, I, for one, thoroughly enjoyed it. Are there questions? If there are no questions...
No, I think we'll
have. You got one? Okay.
Go ahead, Will. Yeah, so the question is, do my colleagues in other countries, especially the developing countries, share my opinions? And I guess I'm allowed to have an opinion, but if you read the paper on the right, which was written by also a good friend of ours, Dr. Peter Raven, he was one of the lead authors on that paper, and he was one of the people who actually orchestrated the CBD originally, and he is the prime person who will tell you it's really restricting research. The gist of the matter is probably you could argue that the developing countries, in some ways, were oversold the idea of how lucrative this was going to be, and that there's socio-economical history here and other things. But their argument is really from a taxonomic, and what they're arguing is let me back up. The CBD was supposed to create a way for which you could get appropriate access and work together, and then in doing so honor the idea of the CBD. The problem is it's been very difficult to get those agreements and to get that access. And so there's a tool there to do it. People just aren't, it's, for some reason, has not been well, I don't want to say managed. No one manages it. But it's stemming that flow. And so it's not that they don't deserve, you know, some recompense for it. But I think, you know, if we assume that everything's going to be a cure for cancer, then you're going to protect everything. But the reality is everything is not going to be a cure for cancer. And so it's not nearly as lucrative. And so we got to find some happy ground where we can have this exchange, because the other side of the argument is that if you're a taxonomist and you do this research and you publish this sequence data, a lot of them are going more and more onto some sort of public access. So the point is, I've just done the work for you, and anyone can have access to that data. So that's the commons, right? So everyone has the ability to benefit. So that's one way to look at it. But you're right, the developing countries, obviously, and it's not just developing countries. We have difficulties with Japan and Mexico, for instance, Brazil. So
we've still got time for another question.
So the question was, how much work do I get to do on the international level? Well, I could do a lot more if I just did it. But we have a real strong focus on what we do nationally. Internationally, we historically have a lot of programs, and it sort of is a nice segue, thank you very much, into the CBD, from the CBD, because we were, in 1980, we organized in the first trip into China since World War II. We headed that up with a consortium of botanical gardens. We were the leaders with folks like Arnold and Morris Arboretum into the 80s and 90s, forming NACPEC. So we've been collecting, but collecting sort of stopped about 2000 to 2008, 2006, 2008, because it became very unclear as to whether we had national access. And the point for us is we have to sort of draw a line, because when we put it into the Germplasm Resources Network, it's freely available. So we have to make sure that if I have it, I have the right to freely give it away. And so we focus a lot on other parts of the world where we do get that access. We've worked on Azerbaijan. We've worked in the Republic of Georgia. So the Caucasus, which is another rich and diverse area. So we try to work where we can. So it's still a very robust program, but there are certain areas that we don't focus on anymore because of it.
Probably handle one more.
Have you let go of your strange love for Catalpa and Chalapas?
Oh, no, wait a minute. Hold on. You heard it here. Yeah. The question is, have I let go of my strange love for Catalpa and Chalapas? By 2100, it will be the new crepe myrtle. By 2100. I'm waiting for a new hire, so there's young people in there. We got some position. Can I do this? Is this unfair? We're going to have some breeding positions open. Go see Dr. Margaret Pooler. She's in the audience. But we're looking at hiring, and so if the new person doesn't want to do it, I understand. But
that's sort of an unfair, blatant recruiting effort. But but we appreciate it, because all jobs for our members are appreciated. I think we're just got about 30 seconds left, so I would like to take the opportunity to once again thank you. It was an excellent presentation.
Thank you.